Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Happy Christmas Eve if you celebrate Christmas. If you don't, happy Wednesday, December 24th. Our team is off for the holiday, so we thought we'd take this opportunity to play some of our favorite segments from recent months as an end-of-the-year toast to the arts. It's a very visual show and a very musical show. We've got slideshows up on our website for you to follow along with conversations about photography from this year, including some amazing photographs of the Earth taken from space by astronaut Chris Hadfield. You may know his beautiful singing voice. He's the one who did the cover of David Bowie's Space Oddity from space. Turns out he also has an eye for photography. Plus, my conversation with Herbie Hancock about his life and times.
There was a unity of spirit. You know, Miles told us he paid us to explore new territory, to, you know, venture out into the unknown, you know, which is great. How many bosses are going to tell you to do that?
Right.
Right.
The Herbie Hancock, talking about the Miles Davis. We'll hear more from Herbie Hancock. We'll also hear about new music, protest music, inspired just now by events in Ferguson, Missouri and Staten Island after the non-indictments in the Michael Brown and Eric Garner cases, and we'll discuss the role of hip-hop in bringing about social change.
We gotta pray.
We Gotta Pray, a new song from Alicia Keys. But first, we start today with a history of New York in 101 Objects. That's the new book from the Times Urban Affairs correspondent Sam Roberts. We will do the hyper-condensed radio version with 10 of those objects, and we have posted these 10 images on our website. If you would like to follow along and see things from a very early New York guidebook, to the kind of sewing machine used in the heyday of the Garment District, to a very familiar political button if you were around in the 80s, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. You'll see the 10 images we have up from the book, and you can follow along. And hello, Sam Roberts. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And before we jump into object number one, what were you after here? Why tell a history of the city in 101 objects?
Well, I was inspired by the British Museum and BBC series A History of the World in 100 Objects and realized that you couldn't do New York in merely 100. It would take at least 101. WNYC itself did 10 objects, and then I did 50 for the Times and decided to turn this into a book. And the hardest thing was not finding 101 objects. It was winnowing them down to 101.
I'll bet. And listeners, you can participate. You can reflect on the objects Sam will be talking about. And you can nominate an object in case Sam ever writes a volume two.
Indeed, so, we set up an email address.
Oh, you did?
objectsofnyc@gmail.com.
Aha. So is there a larger collection that you're displaying online?
Well, we're going to have a website. There's an exhibit going on at the New York Historical Society, and maybe there'll be a volume two.
And let's start at the very beginning of the book with object number one, which is actually a view from Inwood Hill Park at the northern tip of Manhattan. We're looking at a rock formation, and you call the object Fordham Gneiss. That's G-N-E-I-S-S, Gneiss. Why start your book with a rock formation?
Well, it's a good question. What are the criterion for the objects to be included in this book was not too much bigger than a bread box, which is why I left out the Statue of Liberty, the Empire State Building. This rock is a pretty big bread box, I admit, but it's just about the oldest natural object in New York. It dates about 1.2 billion years, and that seemed like a good starting point for anything in a book of 101 objects.
And because, as you explain, the various kinds of rock in different parts of the city have done so much to determine what gets built there. So for people who wonder why there are no skyscrapers in Upper Manhattan, but they're concentrated in Midtown and the financial district, the answer really is geology, isn't it?
That's true. Nowadays, you could build a skyscraper just about anywhere, but certainly with the earlier technology in the 19th century, the early 20th century, it was much more practical to build downtown and Midtown.
You also mentioned tunnels in connection with this rock and the weird but true fact that landlords own the land beneath their property all the way down to the center of the earth. Why bring that up?
Well, because it's one of those New York curiosities that I always wondered about. You know, how far down does it go? And particularly I was interested when you talk about subways and water tunnels and things like that. What is the role of eminent domain in terms of taking control of that property when you have government powers? And apparently landlords do own the property just about to the center of the earth, but the government can take control of it for public purposes.
Object number two was fascinating. I had never seen this before. You call it a guidebook, and the page you display in the book dates all the way back to 1670. And again, listeners, you can see this on our site at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, 10 images, a 10-image slideshow taken from Sam Roberts' new book, A History of New York and 101 Objects. This brief description of New York, formerly called New Netherlands. What is this?
Well, Brian, I particularly like this because it was written by Daniel Denton, an Englishman, and he was also not only wrote a guidebook about New York for Europeans, but he was also a pioneer opportunist, which is sort of in the New York tradition. What he didn't tell the people for whom he was writing the guidebook was that he was a real estate speculator. And what he wanted to do was sell land in what became New York. He wanted them to move over here, leave England, leave other parts of Europe, and buy land in what was then New Netherlands.
And it's so interesting that for people who are not on our site viewing the images, I'm going to read this whole page that you printed here from this book published in 1670, A Brief Description of New York, formerly called New Netherlands, with the places thereunto adjoining, that's adjoining with a Y, together with the manner of its situation, fertility of the soil, S-O-Y-L-E, healthfulness of the climate, and the commodities thence produced, also some directions and advice to such as shall go thither, an account of what commodities they shall take with them, the profit and pleasure that may accrue, which, by the way, A-C-C-R-E-W, accrue to them thereby. Likewise, a brief relation of the customs of the Indians there,
and
by Daniel Denton.
And he said, basically, don't worry about the Indians, no problem, especially with the English in charge.
Yeah, because the first city of New York Chamber of Commerce might have been pushing Daniel Denton to do such a thing. Right?
I think so, especially since he owned some of the land.
By the way, why does this say New York, formerly called New Netherlands? I thought it was New Amsterdam.
Well, he meant the greater New York area, so it went beyond actually the city limits.
Next image in Sam Roberts, A History of New York and 101 Objects. And if you're just joining us again, you can follow along with this slideshow at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Next object, number 15, burial beads. Now, for those not looking, these look like little multicolored Cheerios, kind of. What are these beads?
Well, they are beads with which a African-American woman was buried in what is now known as the African Burial Ground. It was a cemetery for blacks that was then beyond the city limits, north of City Hall. It was rediscovered when the government was building a new federal office building a decade or two ago. It's now part of the National Park Service site. And what it reminded us was how important the black population was to New York City in the 18th, 19th century. About a quarter of the city's population was black. New York was one of the biggest slaveholding centers of the what became the United States. Slaves, slave labor was vital to New York. And there was a wide cross-section of people, from laborers to people who were fairly well-to-do, freed slaves in what became New York at the time.
That's an important reminder for people who haven't studied the city's history closely, that New York was not the South, but slavery did definitely happen here too.
Absolutely. Slaves were mistreated. There were slave rebellions. Slaves were discriminated against by law. And it wasn't until 1799 that a law was actually passed that gave the slaves rights and freedom. And that law didn't take effect till about 1827.
And I wonder what it was like to have a hybrid city like that. We think about slavery in the South and the plantation system where all the blacks were slaves. Excuse me. But in New York, there were plenty of free blacks and there were plenty of slaves at a certain time in history.
Absolutely. And there are a number of items in the book, and I tried not to make this book politically correct, but there are a number of items in the book, and I tried to let people look at history in different ways. And I started out doing the book, of course, thinking I knew everything there was about New York. And one of the joys of doing it.
And most people, by the way, when they say Sam Roberts, the next words out of their mouths are, he knows everything about New York.
The joy of doing what I do for a living is that I keep learning things. And I learned a lot doing this book. And I learned things about the Civil War and the draft riots and other things that are reflected in the objects in this book. And, of course, blacks were mistreated all along the way. And the draft riots, and there's one object in the book that reflects that, in 1863 was sort of the culmination of that.
I remember when that burial ground was discovered. It was only in the 1990s. That's so recent.
Absolutely. And, the fact is that much of the land we live on and walk on, particularly in Manhattan, used to be burial grounds.
Next object, number 23, is a sewing machine. It's a Singer sewing machine that has its manufacture date written right on it, 1849. Why this sewing machine?
Well, it is sort of a generic object. It is a sewing machine, not the sewing machine. And again, this list is my list. It is not the definitive list of 101 objects. It's a sewing machine my grandfather might have used, frankly, in the garment center. It reflected the biggest industry at one time in New York. Again, something generated largely by the Civil War. Clothes that were made for slaves, uniforms that were made, both for the North and to some extent for the South. And at one point, New York was generating about 40% of the men's clothing and 70% of the women's clothing purchased in the United States. When it went from tailor-made to off-the-rack clothing, New York was very, very much the center of that in the 19th century.
That's an incredible stat, those two stats, that I didn't know until I was reading that part of the book. 70% of women's clothing purchased in the entire United States, 40% of all the men's clothing around 1910 being made in New York. Why here, all the way at one corner of the country? This could have been done anywhere, right?
Well, it was cheap labor. It was good labor. It was immigrant labor. And one of the consequences of that, the spinoffs, if you will, was the organization of the labor movement in New York. Not only the labor movement, organized labor per se, but the political ramifications of the labor movement, a left-leaning labor movement in a very democratic, left-leaning state.
So the labor movement succeeded to some degree, and the garment industry moved to Nicaragua.
Just about. That's right.
And I have an ancestral connection to that one. I guess you do, too, from what you said, because my grandfather, my father's father, was one of those immigrants, came through Ellis Island, made his living commuting every day from the South Bronx to the Garment District. Of course, that was in this century, not at the time that the image depicts, but sitting at one of those sewing machines and then going home at night. And the stats that you have there are huge, not only for how much we exported to the rest of the country in terms of clothing, but how big the garment industry was. It was the city's top employment sector for a good long time.
Absolutely true.
All right. History of New York and 101 objects. Next item, number 37, represents mass production in a different sort of way. It's a brass doorknob from a New York City public school.
I love that, and I remember that at PS219 in Brooklyn, frankly, and it showed that people cared about public schools. Now, probably, I hate to admit, some political boss made these brass doorknobs and got a cut from, the Board of Education budget.
But speculating, or that's known history?
I wish I could prove it. But they were beautiful, and they showed a certain respect for public education. And people just remember them, and they are symbolic of the city's commitment, which began actually with black kids in the late 18th century, then with the public school system, then with the Catholic Church emulating the Protestant system in public education in the 19th century. Now, the funny thing is you can't have those doorknobs now. You can only find them probably on eBay because the American with Disabilities Act prevents you from using those. You've got to use the lever-type doorknobs. Huh. So they are no longer acceptable.
And you use the doorknob as a way to riff on public education, as you just did. You do that in the book. But I do wonder about the doorknob itself. It's really a little Art Deco gem. And one former teacher that I know, who shall remain nameless, snatched one of these on his or her way out the door years ago because it just looks so cool, and installed it in his or her home. So do you know if they were mass-produced and were the same in hundreds of school buildings? Because that's the impression that I get.
I believe they were indeed. And when I was looking for an object that defined public education, I could have picked anything. But again, the criteria for picking them was something transformative or something emblematic of a transformation, wanted something that existed. Didn't want a human being, which ruled out Ed Koch, among others, who a number of people suggested as emblematic of New York. What was so fascinating was how many people suggested items of food for the book, all sorts of things. I included some, but couldn't possibly include all.
Which brings us to item number 50, right smack in the middle, or as in the middle as you can get, of 101. I guess 51 is right in the middle of 101. But number 50, The Automat, subtitle, The Origin of Fast Food. For the uninitiated, what was The Automat?
Well, The Automat, I hope there are not too many uninitiated, was that great horn and hearted restaurant where you put nickels in slots and the machine spun around and you pulled out your lemon meringue pie or your baked beans or sandwich or soup or whatever else you wanted. And it was a fascinating way. It actually began in Philadelphia, opened in New York early in the 19th century. And it was a sanitary way. It was an egalitarian way. Everyone had to put in the same nickels, and you sat at the same tables. You didn't leave tips. You never were quite sure how much you were paying for things because you were just putting nickels in a slot. It lasted for a long time. The last one, as I recall, was right near the Daily News where I used to work on 3rd Avenue and 42nd Street. It became a terrific New York institution.
And you have the lifespan of the Automat in New York as being from 1912 to 1991. And actually, probably my earliest memory of Manhattan is of my parents taking me in from Queens and eating at one of those Horn and Hardart Automats. I seem to remember it being near Grand Central. I don't know if that's accurate or not, when I was really little. And it was nostalgia even for my parents at that point. But you go beyond middle-class nostalgia to the Automat as an early place that homeless people congregated, and an Edward Hopper painting in the 1920s that reflected that.
That's right. That famous Edward Hopper painting is called The Automat. It doesn't really look like one, but that's the name of it. And it really was the origin of fast food. Lunch, arguably, was invented in New York. People used to go home and have dinner before the work week became what we know it now, before the Industrial Revolution. But the idea of lunch and a fast food lunch, as I point out in the book, was a New York institution.
The image shows three little glass enclosed cases with a slice of lemon meringue pie in each one and coin slots with the instructions, 2 quarters only. So that one didn't take nickels. And you have Neil Simon in that passage saying he used to hang out at the Automat and he learned more talking to the patrons there than he learned in his 3 years at Princeton. I guess too bad that his parents didn't know that they could keep shelling out quarters and nickels for lemon meringue pie rather than all that money for tuition.
Would have been a good investment.
101 objects, I should say a history of New York and 101 objects with Sam Roberts here. Next item. Number 79. And look, it's a very young and wiry Johnny Carson with a very aging Groucho Marx What's the story? Why is this New York?
Well, if I had been really high tech, I would have included an audio recording, which is all that's left. There apparently is no video. But this was Johnny Carson's first appearance on The Tonight Show in 1962. And who was he introduced by? As I point out in the book, Groucho Marx. Johnny Carson got such a big hand that Groucho Marx said, "Boy, you'd think it was Vice President Nixon who was being introduced." He was being facetious, of course. And the reason Johnny Carson is a icon in this book and an object, if you will, or the show is because he defined New York in the 60s and early 70s to so much of the nation. John Lindsay was the mayor. This was the big city. This was sophistication. This was Fun City, as it was called facetiously in that period of time, the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, it was the time of New York jokes, not particularly flattering. Anytime four people get in a cab and they're not arguing, well, you know, a bank robbery must have taken place, things like that. And it was a defining time for television, too. As I point out in the book, you couldn't even say pregnant pause, the two words together, because they were considered off color. And Carson, who broadcast from New York in the beginning, really defined New York to the rest of the nation.
And now, after a long hiatus, The Tonight Show is back in
Indeed.
New York.
Indeed. But back in a very different New York, too.
Indeed. Next item, number 87. And this is the famous Daily News headline that many have heard about and very few have seen. This is the actual front page of the paper, Ford to City. Drop dead.
It is a great headline. Of course, he never used those exact words, drop dead, but I challenge anyone to say that wasn't his intent. That's what he meant when he denied loan guarantees initially to the city when it was in the middle of its fiscal crisis in the mid-1970s. And that's sort of a companion object to another one that's in the book, and that is Milton Glaser's famous I Love New York logo. And the book includes what I learned was a fascinating story behind that. Milton was asked by the State Commerce Department to draw some sort of graphic for a promotional campaign for the State Commerce Department. He did. The Commerce Department loved it. And then he was in a cab and he thought of another idea. And he went back to the Commerce Department and said, "Hey, I got a great idea." And they said, "Forget about it. You know, this one's already been accepted." And he said, no, let me show it to you." And he did. And it was I Heart New York. And they said, "Wow, this is great." And it, of course, it became one of the most iconic, vivid graphic symbols adopted all over the world.
To this day, though, Milton Glaser is still creating iconic images for his times. Number 91, the ninth out of the 10 that we've got on our site in the slideshow at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And anyone walking around New York in the 80s or anyone who lived through the horribleness of the peak of the AIDS epidemic in the city will remember the silence equals death button.
Well, if you talk about iconic objects, that certainly was one of them. It affected the gay community enormously. It was sort of, in one respect, arguably the launching pad for the gay rights movement. It had an enormous impact in terms of death and devastation on the arts community. And this button, this poster, really became symbolic. In fact, interestingly enough, there's a exhibition now in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, Disobedient Objects, which includes a poster of this symbol as well. It became so powerful.
Let's take a couple of listener calls before we do our final object. Harry in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC. Hi, Harry.
Hi, how are you? Yeah, two items, but I'll start off with the first one. I think it was up until the maybe early 1970s in the Bronx. Originally, I grew up in the Bronx before we moved to Queens, but I remember seeing the cobblestones with the trolley rails before they started tarring everything over in the Bronx. So I feel a New York cobble with a piece of the trolley track.
All right,
I like that.
Iconic. And
you have a second one? Go ahead.
Yeah. Of course, the World Trade Center is no longer standing, but at one time was climbed by Robert Willig, his mother was one of the people who was injured. I think it was the end of World War II when a B-17 had crashed into the Empire State Building.
I didn't know that.
Harry, thank you very much. Both very interesting.
We do have a jar of dust that was collected in Lower Manhattan right after 9/11. That seemed like a sort of mysterious, respectful, enigmatic way of marking 9/11.
Chris in Peekskill, you're at WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Hi,
Hello.
Fellas.
Hey.
Let me just take you off the speakerphone here while I wait. Okay. Hello.
Always good for sound quality to get us off the speakerphone. Hi there.
There you go. Okay. Good morning. I have a piece of coral that was found in on the corner of Seaman Avenue and 204th Street. There was a lot there, and this piece of coral was found on the bottom of the lot.
That's inward, upper Manhattan. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I had it for quite some time. You know, I've done some research, and I used the New York State Earth Science Reference Tables, and I can only assume that it's a few hundred years old and was a part of New York when we were below the equator and under the water. So I just figured I'd bring that up and see if maybe your guest has anything to say about that.
Well, we weren't below the equator, but maybe that part of Manhattan was underwater at some point.
I'm sure it was, and I would suggest you bring it to the American Museum of Natural History, and I'll bet they can tell you exactly what it is.
Interesting. One final item in our super condensed radio version of Sam Roberts' History of New York and 101 Objects. Number 98, very much in the news this year, actually, the Domino Sugar sign about to go away as the former factory space becomes an apartment building. What does the Domino Sugar sign signify historically that you included it in the book?
Well, Brian, the Domino Sugar sign should be coming back, too, eventually. But I was looking for an object.
What do you mean coming back?
Well,
is that part of the plan?
I think the sign itself will be coming back. The building may not, but the sign will. And I was looking for something in the book that would be symbolic of manufacturing in New York. At one point, half the sugar in the country was processed in New York City. It came up by boat, obviously, from Cuba and other places, manufactured here, mostly in Brooklyn, exported to the rest of the country and also the world. And the idea was to capture the fact that New York was a manufacturing capital. As recently as 1950, there were 1 million manufacturing jobs in New York. Now it's hard to exactly measure them, but they're probably something like about 100,000. And we still make an amazing assortment of things, from pianos to 3D printing objects and things like that. But the Domino Sugar sign, the old Silver Cup Bakery sign, which has been retooled, of course, into a movie studio, the Pepsi sign, which is on the waterfront in Long Island City, to me, they symbolize the manufacturing past of New York, which is so historic.
Funny enough, I took a harbor history tour of Baltimore this summer, and there was an almost identical Domino Sugar sign in Baltimore Harbor. And I expected to hear the same tale of it being a former industry converted and a former landmark being converted into condos. But instead, they boasted of their sugar refining industry today and the jobs that that sign represents. Any clue why it would have persisted to some degree as an industry as close as Baltimore but not in New York?
My guess is that labor costs and other costs in the Port of Baltimore were probably a bit cheaper than in the Port of New York.
Then why was it ever in New York? If think about sugar being grown in the Caribbean or in the South in this country, why did they ship it all the way to New York to refine it? Couldn't they have found a port city somewhere, you know, along the southeast coast?
Well, New York, of course, had the best port in the country, and that's one of the reasons, one of the chief reasons it grew into the great city we know today. And also at the time, at least in the beginning in the 19th century and even earlier, the sugar didn't last that long from the final refining process to immediate use. So you wanted to refine it as close as possible to where the consumers were, and that was New York. New York was the most central spot to do that.
Well, that's our super condensed radio version with Sam Roberts of his book, A History of New York and 101 Objects. Sam, did you ever hear the joke in our business that says if they had broadcast news in biblical times, there would have been a report one day that said, God handed Moses 10 commandments today. Two of them were.
Right.
So we've got 10.
Well, we'll save the rest for another book, I guess.
In the radio broadcast of your 101 Objects, listeners, you can see our slideshow of those 10 produced with Sam's kind permission at WNYC.org. Big fun, and we learned some great stuff. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And while you're on WNYC.org, you can get queued up for our next segment with Brandon Stanton of the popular photo blog Humans of New York. Brandon took a trip around the world with the United Nations this year. Call it Humans of the World. So next we'll go through some of the beautiful portraits he took on that trip. They're up on our site at WNYC.org if you want to follow along. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
Just a little grain of sand, New York City. Ooh, how I love you. New York City, baby. Blink your eyes and you're gone.
And you're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio, and it's The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. You have probably heard of Humans of New York, that wildly popular photo blog showing faces of so many New Yorkers. Well, now we're going to do Humans of the World, because if you follow the photo and storytelling project called Humans of New York on Instagram or Facebook or anywhere else, then you may have noticed that earlier this fall, photographer Brandon Stanton, who does this, was on a pretty major trip. He went to 10 countries in 50 days, sharing photographs of people from all over the world, from Iraq to Ukraine to Uganda to Mexico. The trip was in partnership with the United Nations in order to raise awareness for the Millennium Development Goals, and the photographs are mesmerizing. So we've put a few on our website. Listeners, you can follow along. Look at some of the shots that we're going to discuss now from Brandon Stanton's UN trip. It's up on our site. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show to see some of those shots as we talk about some of those people. And Brandon Stanton, welcome back to WNYC and welcome home.
Thank you, Brian.
So let's begin with the first stop of your trip, and we'll go through as many of the photos that we've selected as we can and talk about the goals, too, in the bigger picture, as we go. Brandon, the first photograph on our site is from Erbil, Iraq, and it's dated August 9th, the same week that President Obama announced airstrikes against ISIS to protect that city. Was the plan to go to Erbil first because of the conflict?
Absolutely not. That was kind of one of the strange coincidences of the trip, or amazing or terrifying, whatever you want to call it, that the day, you know, we were going to start the trip off with Iraq, and it just happened, you know, during the planning of the trip, it was relatively stable. And then the day that I landed in Iraq was the day that the Mosul Dam got taken, which kind of started this domino effect of events that led to Obama calling for airstrikes. And so, you know, the few days that I spent there kind of stopping people on the street and collecting their stories in much the same way I do in New York happened to be the time that this conflict was escalating. And so all these refugees were flowing into the area, which kind of, you know, made for this amazing cross-section of humanity and stories.
And the photograph is of a family standing in what looks like a mall, maybe?
No, that's not a mall. It's an art gallery, actually, you know, which I think was one of the – and whenever I go somewhere that there's a lot of bad headlines coming out, I think one of the main reactions from my audience is, oh, it's, you know, much calmer or much more stable or, you know, much more cosmopolitan than I thought. And the photo we're looking at now is just a – large family of Iraqis, these are Kurds, in an art museum, just kind of posing for the photo, and they're talking about how they try to expose their family to kind of liberal things. And, you know, I think that was very surprising to my audience because all they were seeing were bad headlines. And I think, you know, if there's one thing that is kind of, I hope, to be a takeaway from the trip is that, you know, one thing that I've realized is that when there's bad headlines coming out of a place, what you have is you have journalists who go into these places looking for the most extreme stories or the most violent images or the kind of the most tense, you know, headlines to provide, whereas in 95% of the life that's also going on there is just absolutely normal. And so, you know, I hopefully the portraits that I was able to get were able to kind of depict a more broad cross-section of what was actually going on in the place.
And so next we go to Jordan. We've posted a photograph you took of a woman with a big bright smile, and she's at the Za'atari refugee camp. And the caption is so funny. Will you share it?
Yeah, well, the caption, it was said in through translation, is, "This one likes photos too much. If he takes one more photo, I will break his camera, but don't translate that." So she was, and I'll tell you, the culture in the Middle East, especially in certain areas, is very conservative. And so, you know, when you're just approaching random strangers, you find that you find a lot more males that will agree to let you take their photo than females, just for cultural and religious reasons. And so we were at the Za'atari refugee camp, which is for Syrian refugees, and I told my translator, you know, I asked him if he knew any young women who would allow us to take their photo. And so we found this woman, and she was kind of like really, because she allowed us to take her photo, but like she said, that if he asked me any questions, I'm going to break his camera. So,
she didn't break the camera.
Right.
Can you talk about your process a little bit?
Well, as you know, it's very much the same as I do in New York. What I do is, you know, the goal is to find a random stranger on the street and try to get kind of as intimate or personal a glimpse into their lives as possible in a very short amount of time. So what I'll do is I'll just kind of stop someone and I'll ask them to take their photo. And then I kind of just transition into very personal questions, things like, what was the happiest moment of your life? What was the saddest moment of your life? And what I find is that, you know, the kind of the most pivotal stories in our life tend to revolve around very strong emotions, whether that be anger or guilt or happiness or sadness. And so a lot of times when I'm interviewing someone on the street, I'll ask them to identify the time when they felt that emotion the strongest.
But when you were here talking about your Humans of New York series, we talked about that, but I noticed that you wrote that those usual questions that you ask to get great stories here, like someone's happiest moment or saddest moment, just seemed inappropriate when people were fleeing war like they were in these intense situations in the refugee camps or in Erbil.
Right.
So you ask different questions.
Well, especially in refugee camps. And you know, what I found is that there's certain places in the world that the present circumstances are so overwhelming, whether that's, where's food going to come from? Where's my job going to come from? Is ISIS going to be here tomorrow? That, you know, the present circumstances are so overwhelming that there's not really room in the mind to have the luxury of having relationship problems or even having ambitions or dreams. And so that my normal, you know, line of questioning, which is to kind of identify these emotional times or what people's hopes or dreams might be.
First world problems.
Yeah, exactly. We're met with kind of confusion in light of what people are going through right now. And so, you know, this is one of the eye-opening things for me, was how many people in the world, 99% of their thought life and their brain is devoted to trying to handle present circumstances.
You may know Brandon Stanton's Humans of New York photography series from Instagram or Facebook or elsewhere. He has just come back or recently come back from a trip to 10 countries in 50 days and photographed so many people around the world. If you want to follow along with some of his shots that we're talking about for another few minutes, you can see them on our site at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Brandon was gracious enough to let us pull a few of the images and embed them on our site at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. And so the next photo is from Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's of a woman in a beautiful, bright, I guess I'd call it a pink and white outfit with flowers, flowery skirt, pink top. Tell us about her.
You know, this is a woman, and she's kind of, you know, standing in front of a, you know, rather humble, would be a euphemism, I guess, kind of abode. And, you know, I asked her what her dream was, and she said to be the mother of a doctor, the mother of a minister, or the mother of an engineer. And, you know, I think that was a constant theme in Africa, or, you know, some of the less developed areas that I went to in Asia or the Middle East, is that, you know, the ambitions a lot of times were the exact same as the people that I talked to in New York. The ambitions were the exact same. But, you know, the kind of sad corollary of that is that, you know, a lot of times the people I talk to in New York can see a very clear path. The institutions and the infrastructures are in the place to allow someone to accomplish these dreams. And what I found in a lot of areas is that these people had very large ambitions, but whether the education system wasn't there, the jobs weren't there, the opportunities weren't there, they didn't have access to loans or anything like that, their maneuverability to accomplish these dreams were very limited. And that juxtaposition of very big dreams and very limited means to accomplish dreams was very poignant for me.
Next stop, Entebbe, Uganda. And it's a little boy who tells you that he wants to be an engineer. That's his big dream. And that he would build a factory that makes new books so that everyone can have new books for school. It's so heartbreaking as well as heartwarming, isn't it?
Right. And this, you know, a lot of the audience really connected with this guy. He was just a young man sitting out in front of a school in Uganda. And, you know, I asked him what he wanted to do. And one of his greatest parts was he said he wanted to be an engineer. And I love how specific he got. I asked him what the hardest part about being an engineer would be. And he said, keeping your employees from walking off with your cement. I loved how specific of an answer that was for such a young boy. And then I asked him, you know, what kind of buildings would he build? And he said he would build a factory so that everyone could have new books from school because his parents weren't able to afford new books for school.
And since you were on this trip in conjunction with the UN's Millennium Development Goals, one of them is achieve universal primary education. So
right.
Boy, did this connect with that.
Right. And, you know, that was one of the wonderful things about the UN is that, you know, the trip was on the, you know, in honor of these Millennium Development Goals. And, you know, they sent me to these places, but, you know, they said, just do your work naturally, and that we're sure that the needs of these goals and kind of the needs of these communities will kind of come out naturally. And like you pointed out, they did. You know, I wasn't going up to people and saying, you know, what are your thoughts on the needs for education, or what are your thoughts on climate change? You know, I was just asking them about their stories and letting these things kind of come out naturally as themes.
So let's do one more before we run out of time. And you went to Kyiv, Ukraine. And despite what's been happening in Ukraine this year, this photograph is really fun. It's of a dad carrying his daughter on his shoulders. And he says, we had our first day of kindergarten yesterday, and I'm already starting to mentally prepare myself for the first boyfriend.
Right.
Haha. So there's a universal.
Right. You know, Kyiv was remarkably developed and calm, especially in relation to, you know, the headlines that we're seeing from it. You know, the conflict there, obviously there is a general feel or a general worry that the conflict could escalate into general war. But right now it's a very kind of isolated regional conflict in the very far east of the country. And so everywhere, whether it was Odessa or Kyiv that I went to, life was very much going on as normal, beyond that kind of general fear that it could become abnormal. But, yeah, other than that, the stories were very similar to those I get in New York.
So after all your time photographing humans of New York for that blog and now going to 10 countries, are you seeing the city differently since you've been back, or are people here?
You know, like I said, it's just, you know, the spectrum of experiences have been enlarged so much. You know, it's just like when you're sitting in front of somebody in the refugee camp, and I was at a refugee camp, and you could just tap anybody on the shoulder, and they would have the most horrific story about seeing their father executed in front of their eyes or spending so much time in prison. So, you know, obviously the spectrum of experiences has widened, and so any story I hear in New York's going to be put on that spectrum in a different place than it used to be. But, you know, there's still – this is, if you don't mind me saying, the greatest city in the world. And, you know, so many people from these countries I went to are living here. And, you know, the stories in this city are still as remarkable as they always were.
And everybody who you met around the world could potentially be living there here. Or you could be finding their family members.
Right. Just a short train ride to Queens
exactly.
Or Brooklyn. Right.
Or any of the boroughs.
Yeah.
And we will leave it there with Brandon Stanton of Humans of New York, back in the city now after his 10-country, 50-day trip with the United Nations to raise awareness about the UN Millennium Development Goals. His new book is a collection of photos of kids in New York called Little Humans, and it's out now. Or you can see his Humans of New York blog and this one, too, on Instagram, on Facebook. Do people continue to use Humans of New York to see this or look for Humans of the World?
Yeah, no. The everything's housed on the Humans of New York blog.
Right.
So yeah,
so
no,
just look for Brandon Stanton, Humans of New York on the social media site of your choice. Brandon, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Brian.
It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
The police coming straight from the underground. A young got it bad, cause I'm brown.
We got to fight the power, don't be. Fight the power.
The battle outside raging. We'll soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times, they are a-changing.
Well, the times, they were a-changing 50 years ago, and in the 80s, too, as we heard Dylan, Public Enemy, MWA, and Sam Cooke in that protest song montage. And the times, they are still a-changing. This month, Questlove, frontman and drummer for The Roots, challenge fellow artists to write new protest songs and be, quote, a voice of the times that we live in. Artists like Tom Morello, G-Unit, J. Cole, and most recently Alicia Keys have all released songs protesting injustice since the deaths of Eric Garner and Michael Brown. Here's 45 seconds of J. Cole's Be Free, released in August, just after Michael Brown was killed.
All we want to do is take chains off. All we want to do is break the chains up. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is take the chains up. All we want to do is break the chains up. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free. Can you tell me why? Every time I step outside, I see my die.
J. Cole from Be Free. So what does music mean to social justice movements today? Brown University professor and director of the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity in America, Tricia Rose, is here to discuss and listen to a few more tracks with us. Tricia, welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thanks, Brian. It's my pleasure.
First, what did you make of Questlove's call just the other day for protest songs when you first heard about it?
Jumped up and down, super excited. I mean, Questlove is always, you know, an impressive leader of his generation around music and creativity and breaking boundaries, but also, you know, paying attention politically and to the social importance of what being a creative leader means. And so I was just thrilled that he came out making this request. It was not a demand. It wasn't a fiery, you know, negative statement. It was an invitation, a heartfelt invitation to, you know, all of these creative leaders to think about the role of music in galvanizing social change, not as just a strategy, but as a part of voicing the community's feelings at a given moment. So I'm hoping people are penning songs right now as we speak.
The J. Cole song we just sampled from, Be Free, gives me chills when I listen to it. Almost sounds like we walked in on him praying in his room, kind of upset, but praying. Is this sense of intimacy and cri de coeur one important way to do a civil rights song?
It is one really important way. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, J. Cole talked about that really emerging in the middle of the night in a studio where he was, a home studio, I believe, where he was just racked with pain and anguish about Ferguson in the first round of protests. So I think that what he's able to convey there is, you know, just that raw sense of despair, but also hope, right? Because, you know, he's basically saying, you can't take my soul. right? Even though you can break me down in some ways, you can't take my soul. And that's a long-standing trope. I mean, again, for those of us who pay attention to Black culture and history, it's exhilarating to hear that thread of reality being articulated. That is to say, I am in pain, I am mistreated, but you can't take my soul.
And in that lyric we played, I couldn't tell for sure. Did he say no one can take my soul, or did he say no gun can take my soul?
He said no gun, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I think he did. And here is J. Cole in an interview in Complex magazine when he was in Ferguson talking about his inspiration for that song.
I had already made the song. I was like, what am I doing? I got a chance to go be in this, like, and feel this. And we came, not for no interviews, we came to talk, listen, and feel goosebumps and love amongst Black people, because we ain't seen this in our generation. You ain't never seen nothing like this.
And that was, of course, during the rolling protests in Ferguson before the non-indictment. And you wrote a book called The Hip Hop Wars. Would you say that there is kind of a thrust in the, what should I say, the kind of cultural direction of hip hop, because it has several cultural directions, which is part of what you've written about, that, you know, that could be a defining moment here for the music?
There could be, and I that's part of what I think Questlove was getting at. I don't think he was limiting his conversation to hip hop, but, you know, hip hop has a particularly powerful framework for speaking to this kind of urban racialized crisis. So I think, you know, it's been a little bit shocking. I mean, and again, his call was affirmative, right? But it also speaks to a gap. I mean, where are all the rappers, right? I mean, I kind of have to, you know, I mean, J. Cole did this song, which is great. But when you think about how much hip hop is about narrating personal experience, long form storytelling, you know, the poetic impulse, which, you know, is very easy, it doesn't require elaborate orchestration. And yet, and has historically, as a genre, been very much on the front ends of immediate responses. A very long time ago, Chuck D called hip hop, you know, basically Black urban CNN, right? Mm. Sort of breaking news. You could really bring the what just happened last week. So where is it? You know, and this speaks to the crisis that we're dealing with in terms of the commercialization of people's music into sound bites that sell products that make people feel good. And, you know, perhaps there's some fear, as Questlove mentioned in his post, that they might get Dixie chicked, you know, which is, you know, banned from Clear Channel and other outlets for, you know, daring to challenge political authority and state will. You know, so it's a serious issue out here. There's a lot at stake for these very famous artists to make potentially politically radical statements, but we need them more than ever.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, New York, and New Jersey Public Radio. I think Linda in Brooklyn, Tricia, wants to push back a little bit on the moral standing of some artists anyway to weigh in on social protest. Linda, you're on WNYC. Hello.
I just, when I heard that G-Unit had a song, I wanted to point out that the G originally stood for gangsta, and I think that they promote gun violence among Black men, so it's kind of hypocritical to write a song protesting police shooting of Black men, since it's a pretty small percentage of the gun violence against Black men.
Tricia Rose?
Well, thanks, Linda. I understand how that might make some kind of sense to you, but I want to push back and say that a couple of things. One, gun violence in urban communities are not just the result of young people who just promote gun violence. We're talking about the systemic destruction of community networks. When that happens, violence escalates all around the world. That is to say, when you have communities that are frayed and broken, and I mean, in serious ways, not just a little bit, you end up with significant amounts of violence. So we have to understand the articulation of violence among high levels of unemployed, ill-educated, under a lot of pressure young people as a symptom of a crisis, not necessarily a moral failing. These are young people. Secondly, you know, people aren't divided into good and bad. You have a lot of early, for example, gangster rap that was very focused on not only challenging the police, but poverty. And yes, some of them responded to that in inappropriate ways. But, you know, America's own history is fraught with that contradiction. We're the biggest, you know, gangster nation there is. We took all the land from the Native Americans, and yet we also have are known for one of the most important democratic documents in the modern world. So the contradictions exist everywhere, and I think we want to encourage young people to do the best they can, but also be honest about their failings. And I appreciate your insight on that.
Linda, thank you for your call. I guess it goes to a larger conversation. I mean, if you've seen the poll numbers out today, Tricia, you know that white America and black America see these issues so differently. And there's a big conversation taking place in white America about why isn't there as much focus on crime politically and on the streets in terms of protest as there is on these police shootings. I mean, I think the most famous moment of it was Rudy Giuliani putting it, you know, very inartfully on Meet the Press, where he made it seem like, why aren't black people protesting more against black people? But the question, the way that other people are asking it is, why isn't there in high crime communities, why isn't there as much publicly expressed outrage against the criminals, which put them much more at risk than there is against the police?
Well, Brian, that's a whole other segment, which will take a minute. But the short answer is, number one, black people do make the case that they're threatened and worried about crime. And there's tremendous outcry. But truth be told, mainstream media is not really all that interested in black community problems. Black people are very rarely featured unless they're doing something dramatically dangerous and horrible. And most of that crime is considered, you know, within the black community. So it doesn't get the coverage. Number two, if the police functioned in ways that were less racist, people would call the police more often, and those conversations would take place. But thirdly, the police are there to protect people. That is their job. It is categorically different for a police force whose tax dollars are generating their salaries for, to actually come and occupy your neighborhood and criminalize everyone in it. It's categorically different. Number four, all racial crime is actually similar race on race, intra-racial, mainly because of the continued segregation of the United States. So white on white crime is just as significant as black on black crime. So it's a false construction created to further racialize black people as aberrant. So it's not to say it shouldn't be talked about, but it's categorically different.
So let's get back to the music tour here. And since the caller brought up G-Unit, the South Jamaica Queens hip-hop crew that 50 Cent is in, they released the song and music video, Ish. Here is a short clip from that.
Walking here on that. I've been turned up all day busting shots. Ever since Mike Brown went down my whole city like cop. Run the red light to stop. Bust his head when you broke the clock. Count my bread up, I run the block. I don't play around with you. Bring it to you if you really want this. My hard cold, I seen something hot. Blowing kush, but I'm staying focused. Cause is moving, they think you're not. That got my brother shot, standing right in front of his mother's spot. But that got about 10 of them popped, and last night another one of them dropped. We don't do no peace treaties, no backing down, no calling quits. Kid, tell these how quick Buck could get on my New Orleans. Like, what, hey? Say, bro, you must not know me. You want war? Okay.
All right, I think we got all the required bleeps in there and to keep our FCC license. But, Tricia, what a range of expression between J. Cole and that.
Yeah. No, hip-hop is such a diverse form, and black music, and music in general, right, within and across forms, so diverse within artists and across. But, you know, I mean, I'm not a big fan, to go back to Linda's point, I'm not a big fan of G-Unit, and I've written extensively on, you know, the disturbing way that a certain kind of gangster philosophy has taken over hip-hop as its most viable brand of masculinity. And, you know, I'm not happy about it. I think a variety of negative outcomes come from that. It's the product of many things, but a lot of negative outcomes. And this song, in many ways, represents some of that kind of unbridled outlaw psychology, right? Now, at the same time, I would say that you have to allow for an understandable level of rage and outrage and refusal to sort of participate. This happens in many social movements where you have elements that are like, look, we're not negotiating. You know, you think about the Panthers, or you think about, you know, Black Power movement in general. You know, said, look, we've been nonviolent. We're getting gunned down. No change is happening, and we're not playing by the rules anymore. So, you know, a kind of lawless, unjust treatment of people produces lawless responses, and certainly responses that don't suggest, you know, collaboration and you know, getting along. So I have no problem with it, and I think sometimes you have to be prepared to understand people are willing to die for their freedom, and that's understandable. At the same time, I think you want to encourage young people to be productive and proactive and systematic now, because this is a tremendous opportunity that I'm so proud of, you know, teenagers and 20-somethings who just turned it into the kind of movement it should be. And I'm willing to walk behind them, you know, whether they're angry or not, as long as we're moving toward the kind of goals that you know, would really make the differences we need.
And with public expressions of rage and indignation continuing across the country day after day after day, we're talking with Tricia Rose from Brown University and author of The Hip Hop Wars about some of the musical expressions. One of the hooks here is that Questlove from The Roots put out a call for musicians to write new songs in response to this moment just the other day. And some were doing it anyway, and we'll continue to sample from some of those as we go. Alicia Keys up next in a minute. But let's take another phone call, and I'm happy to say that guitarist Vernon Reed, best known as guitarist in Living Color, is calling in. Hey, Vernon, thanks for calling in on WNYC.
Hey, what's going on, Brian? Hi, Tricia.
Hey, Vernon, how you doing?
It's been too long. It's been
way too long.
So I just have a couple of thoughts, because I live in the section of Staten Island where Eric Garner was killed. I live in North Shaolin in St. George, which is right next to Tompkinsville. One thing that I have to say again and again, where Eric Garner was killed is not a high crime district. That block, I know that block very well, and so the amount of force that was sent is completely out of proportion. That's one thing. Another thing that strikes me is that Eric Garner is the kind of brother that people would walk by and not see. And it's wild. You know, I was at my gym and I saw LeBron James had the I Can't Breathe T-shirt on, and I just found it fascinating to me. Eric Garner is the kind of dude that celebrities would not even think about, that people would just walk around and avoid. So it's fascinating to me that this brother had to lose his life for him to be seen, because hip-hop has lost complete touch with that person. Mm. You know, there's a whole obsession with riches and material goods and being number one, and Eric Garner is exactly the kind of person hip-hop is not paying any attention to. And so it's kind of shameful in a way. It's great. I mean, the J. Cole thing is beautiful, but hip-hop is,
right.
I mean, talking about mainstream hip-hop, is not connected to a person like him or Michael Brown right now. And as far as a recommendation, my song that I think about, I think about KRS-One, The Sound of the Police, because this has been going on for years. Mm-hmm. This kind of abuse and this kind of, because you're nobody. You know, Eric Garner died partly because he was a big black nobody to the people that killed him. You know, you can think of it as two events. At the point at which, you know, Eric Garner strikes to me, aside from saying, don't touch me, he never actually resisted. When he was on the ground, it's not like he was fighting. It was not like he was throwing punches. And when he said, I can't breathe, he was in the care of those officers. There's a standard of care. Once you apprehend somebody, once someone lowers their weapon or whatever they have, it changes the nature of the engagement. So he says, I can't breathe, and he's ignored. I can't breathe, and he's ignored. I can't breathe, and he's ignored. I can't breathe, and then he's dead.
Vernon, what'd you think of that Barclays Center display last night, LeBron and everybody with those shirts?
You know, there are two things I think about that. I think it's beautiful that people that are high-net individuals are showing some sort of support to a brother like that who, as I said, on a class basis, they would pay no attention to. I think it's beautiful that they are. But it strikes me that when I looked at the T-shirts, I would have rather them taken a white T-shirt and written it in Sharpie, because those shirts are being sold by somebody. You know, those shirts are being manufactured and sold. Is Darnest family getting that money?
That's a great question.
Or is this another capitalist moment?
Tricia Rose, want to jump in here with Vernon?
Yes, definitely. First of all, Vernon, I just want to tell Brian's listeners, in case they're sleeping on Living Color and, you know, the incredible legacy that you've created and been a part of, that I'm just really happy to hear from you here today. But, you know, a couple things. One, you know, the not a high crime district is very important, because one of the things that the two major cases we're looking at now illuminate is a systemic national pattern of criminalizing black working class communities and criminalizing all the people in it, especially the young men, but not limited to the young men. The young women, the older men, the older women, everybody's criminalized. Being in the wrong place, a teacher on a lunchtime break, going to the corner store, they'll say, well, you're in a drug area. You know, they just sort of label entire areas negative and problematic and use that as an excuse to frisk, to stop, to harass. And so it is a certain kind of hypervisibility and invisibility at the same time that produces. It doesn't matter who you are, right? You're just a nobody, as Vernon says, but you're a nobody who's under this incredible vicious surveillance. So it's a very powerful dynamic, that scene that Vernon described, and the context. And it's important to say these communities are not just hotbeds of psychotic, crazed crack dealers. These are human beings who are living their lives working, if they're lucky, minimum wage jobs or around there, surviving and creating opportunities as best they can for their kids. And we've lost sight of that. And I couldn't agree more about what's happened to hip-hop. I mean, that's a lot of what Hip-Hop Wars is about, is to say, look, we can't go back. Hip-hop has grown technically and artistically, but narratively it has atrophied in the commercial mainstream. It's sort of fossilized around the gangster pimpo trinity, as I call it, right? It's like a religion of the triangle of the despair that a lot of economic loss has produced. But, you know, again, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, like many winter trees, you know, it can be dormant and come back, right, with all of its life. But I think we do have to hold it to the standard that Vernon's asking us to hold it to, which is to say, where is the music for the people, right? For the people, no matter what money they have. This economic market economy has taken over. And in Hip Hop Wars, I have this phrase that I say, what people say, what can you do? And I say, well, look, we live in a market economy, but we must not let the market economy live in us. You know, we have to have a different value system. So thank you, Vernon. Thank you so much.
No, I just want to say two more things, just two quick things. One is, all of this is kind of predicated around the fact that he was selling Lucy's. And in all of this, no one has mentioned, did Turgana have any cigarettes on his person? I don't think he had a cigarette on his person when he was brought down.
Right.
Number two, I was in an event at the Liberation Bookstore where I met Tully Qualley's mom, and Nelson George was there, and Saul Williams read some poems. And one of the things that was really beautiful, he wrote a bunch of his new work, and one of the things he talked about was he was grappling with this very moment. And that's really, I don't know if it's everybody saying the politically correcting or the right thing, but we all have to grapple with this moment. That's why it's lasted so long. It's not just the fact, it's the I can't breathe. It's the fact that nobody in that video, no cop says, yo, back up, is he okay? If a cop had said, is he okay, while it was going on, yo, back up on him, we got him, we wouldn't be in this moment now. He was treated like they were big game hunters, and he was treated like a piece of meat. There's no urgency. Once he's passed out, they're like standing around.
Where was anybody giving him CPR?
That's the thing. They say courtesy, professionalism, and respect on the side of police cars. Where was the CPR for Eric Garner? Where was any of that? Courtesy, professionalism, and respect. When he was brought down, they were done with him. He was a nobody. There were no concerns. If any of the officers showed a modicum of concern, say, yo, is he okay? Yeah. That much, we wouldn't be where we are right now.
That's also why I've been talking on the show, Vernon, about how I think that the focus is going to move in the internal NYPD investigation and in the federal investigation from just Daniel Pantaleo to the other officers and what they did or didn't do on the scene as well. But you know what? That's for another segment.
Yep.
I want to get back to the music. And, Vernon, thank you so much for adding a lot.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me have a stay. Thank you.
Vernon.
Great to hear you. All right. Take care, Vernon.
Next song up, Alicia Keys. She just last week released this, and it seems to be picking up some traction at protests. Here's a little of Alicia Keys' new song, We Gotta Pray.
We gotta pray, pray for the world tonight. We gotta save, somebody save somebody tonight. Fire in the air, what the hell going on? Sirens everywhere, singing that street song. Violence everywhere, barely holding on. What the hell going on? Do you know who you are? Do you know who we are? We
I'd say she can't match J. Cole for the grief in his voice, but still, you know, her smooth beauty there in We Gotta Pray. I don't know. I could see people linking arms and singing the beginning of that.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, it's a different kind of prayer. You know, it's a different kind of process. I mean, J. Cole it's a very private, you know, grief. But you also have to figure out how to grieve in community, and that means, you know, making a call for the idea of, you know, humanity as a whole. So she's speaking in a bigger picture, right? How do we think about humanity as a whole? How do we deal with human violence? How do we deal with dehumanization? To go back to this notion that Eric Garner was treated like big game, you know, that he was just not a human being at a certain point. And that's the only way I can explain their responses to him. So, you know, this idea of prayer is so important and has such a big history. And I think about African American music from the beginning, you know, from spirituals on up, using both the Bible itself and biblical storytelling, but the notion of imagining better days, and what's the mechanism for imagining something that is not right in front of you, for that kind of faith that you have to step out on to really imagine changes that seem far away. So it's a beautiful song. I'm proud of her.
Song just days old from Alicia Keys. All right, one more. And it's not just R&B and hip-hop or folk music, the only genres of music that people turn to during times of unhappiness with, you know, with the social conditions in the country. Rage Against the Machine guitarist Tom Morello's new song, Marching on Ferguson, brings rock into this as well. Here is about a minute of Marching on Ferguson, Tom Morello.
And no patience, I'm under surveillance. Wish that I would have paid less. Different gloves, same fits. I'm marching on Ferguson. I'm marching tonight. And half mass, figuring I get the last laugh, carving up that golden calf with a blowtorch and gas mask. I'm marching on Ferguson. I'm marching tonight.
So, Trisha Rose from Brown University and author of The Hip Hop Wars, before you go, how would you put this cultural and political moment in historical context? Like, the most broadly galvanizing civil rights movement and maybe, you know, artist, and maybe also civil rights moment for artistic expression, Since when?
Oh, my goodness. You know, really since the late 1960s, early 70s. I mean, to me, there's really nothing that comes close to what I'm seeing now. But, you know, again, mass incarceration, stop and frisk, racial profiling, police deaths, the whole system, you know, mandatory minimums, you know, racialized sentencing has been for the past 30 years the most important, certainly African-American civil rights issue. I mean, it's just a fundamental case of taking people's physical liberty, permanently preventing their ability to vote, their economic viability, you know, all kinds of fundamental civil rights have been, you know, really retracted and didacted from through the prison industrial complex. So to me, this is the issue. And the fact that so many genres and so many groups of people and so many young and old people of all racial backgrounds, I mean, you're looking at the best sort of rainbow coalition in these protests, real everyday working people and the middle class. Everyone said, this is enough. This is destroying the country. It is, the militarization of our entire country. It's not going to happen anymore. That's what I hear everyone saying. And, you know, as many battle cries as we can come up with that are fun to dance to or easy to chant, more power to them.
Will Reprise, J. Cole, Be Free, as we go out here and then continue on the other side of a break. Patricia Rose. Tricia Rose, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And I'm in denial. And it don't take no x-ray to see right through my smile.
I know. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, our end-of-the-year Toast to the Arts continues with some of our favorite recent segments, Herbie Hancock on his memoirs.
All we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is break the chains off. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is break the chains off.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it is not every day that you get to meet one of your musical heroes, but today is such a day for me. Herbie Hancock is here, the legendary jazz and sometimes funk or even hip-hop keyboard master and composer, known for his body of work, of course, but also his years on some of Miles Davis' greatest recordings. And did you know Herbie Hancock made his public performance playing Mozart at age 11. We will talk in a second. We're listening to a sample of his classic Watermelon Man from 1962. Let's enjoy. And always changing with the times, here's a sample of the 1973 version of Watermelon Man. Hancock has just published a memoir called Possibilities, and what a treat. Herbie, welcome to WNYC.
Oh, thank you, Brian.
You know, what I've always been so inspired by you and Miles, is not just the music itself, but how both of you always continue to change and not get into a rut in one style, like a nostalgia act. Is that something you've been doing consciously over your career?
Well, in a way, it's Miles' fault. he's the guy that really encourages musicians to explore new territory. He said, I pay you to do that. And that kind of stuck with me. And it actually fit in with the kind of what's in my DNA in a way, because I've mm-hmm. always been a curious person ever since I was a little kid, and I was always trying to figure out how things work.
Tell us a little bit about your early life before we hear some more music and talk about it. Growing up in Chicago, how did you come to be classically trained?
Well, I took piano lessons. They didn't teach jazz piano lessons back then. I mean, you'd learn jazz from the streets. But I wasn't even interested in jazz when I was 7 years old. To me, jazz was my parents' music. They listened to Duke Ellington and Count Basie.
They did. So you had jazz in your home.
Oh, yeah. I did have jazz in my home. But I didn't pay any attention to that. I paid attention to classical music and to rhythm and blues until I was 14. And that's when I saw someone my age improvising on my instrument, a kid in one of my classes on a variety show that my high school used to give. And I was shocked and surprised that here's somebody doing something on my instrument that I don't know how to do. Mm. And I liked what he did. I didn't understand it, but I could tell that it was organized and that he knew what he was doing.
And it's probably a good thing that you weren't too classically trained at that point, that you weren't older, because I know classical pianists who aspire to play jazz, and once it's ingrained in them to read the music on the page, they have a hard time getting off the page and starting to improvise.
Oh, absolutely. I understand. At that time, because I was 14 and had started playing classical music when I was 7, I had 7 years of classical music under my belt. And the first stuff I tried to do sounded with improvisation, with jazz anyway.
Stilted?
That sounded stilted, yeah. I couldn't improvise yet, but I tried to copy some things off of some George Shearing records that I liked.
Uh-huh.
Because this kid that I heard had been listening to George Shearing, and he said, if you like what I did, get some George Shearing records.
Great jazz pianist of that time. Did you ever aspire to make it as a classical musician and a jazz musician, both like Wynton Marsalis?
I do now.
Do you play classical?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, first I was an engineering major in college, and then after 2 years of that, I changed back. I comfortably say I changed back to music because I'd been doing music before for 9 years, really, from the time I was 7 to the time I was 16. But I was already hooked by jazz. That's why I switched back to music as a major. But I was studying classical music again, which I was familiar with. But I had kind of stopped that at the time I graduated from college, and my whole interest was in jazz.
Yeah.
But I listened still to classical music. I didn't stop that. But it was in recent years that I decided to, because of circumstances that presented themselves in front of me, like the Grammy Awards, where Ken Ehrlich, the producer, wanted for the 50th anniversary of the Grammy Awards to have classical music really well represented, along with, you know, pop and rock. And so he wanted Long Long and myself to play George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. I didn't readily say yes because I hadn't played classical music in years.
Forehand with Long Long.
Especially with Long Long. I was like insane, but I finally sort of bit the bullet and said, okay, I'll do it. But I had to practice my tail off.
And I guess Gershwin is a good intersection point where classical and jazz
absolutely
intersect. In the early 60s, it seemed like every album Miles did with you and the band was breaking new ground. Each one was an experiment with different tonalities and textures or different degrees of being electric as electric instruments were coming into use. And I want to play a little sample, folks, of a Herbie Hancock composition from the Miles Davis ESP album recorded in 1965. And this is not swing or bop. This is a ballad, but not just a ballad. They're looking for something here. Herbie on piano, Miles on trumpet, Wayne Shorter on sax, looking for new sounds. Listen. Thank you. Little One, Herbie Hancock composition, and Herbie on piano from Miles Davis' 1965 album ESP. What were you searching for there?
Well, in a way, I think my classical roots still shine through a little bit, even on this composition. But I did get a chance to delve more into the classical arena after that Grammy Award performance by myself and Long Long. We did a whole tour in Europe where he was able to play actually in some jazz festivals for the first time. He did the Montreal Jazz Festival with
me.
And
could he hack it?
Oh, he loved it. He didn't have to improvise anything. But he, because he loved the fact that I was improvising, he started playing around with some improvisation himself. And now he's been doing, now he's hooked.
How would you describe how inventive the dynamic was among the Miles Davis band members doing those albums in the 60s? What was it like in the room?
It was, on one hand, electric. On another hand, it was unified. There was a unity of spirit. You know, Miles told us he paid us to explore new territory, to, you know, venture out into the unknown, you know, which is great. How many bosses are going to tell you to do that?
Right.
Right. So it was an incredible experience. And at the same time, very much in support of how my life journey continued after my tenure with Miles.
And by 1983, hip-hop was in the air, and Herbie Hancock started using scratch and other turntable techniques, and he had this hit single with Rocket. Here's a sample. Maybe the most familiar Herbie Hancock tune of all to a general public. Did hip-hop light you up in the early 80s, or was that a commercial turn? Where'd that come from?
Light me up. That's funny. That's the name of one of my albums. Actually, it was my interest, not primarily in hip-hop itself, but really scratching. But then my natural curiosity led me to explore more about the whole hip-hop movement.
How much guff did you have to take from jazz purists or the media for venturing in that direction?
Oh, plenty. Didn't bother me. I was used to it by that time. You know, I got flack for doing Headhunters, so for me, I expect it.
Back in the 70s, you were already getting
if
that
I'm
flack.
Not getting flack, then I'm not really trying hard enough.
You're not trying. All right, one more taste. You won the Grammy for Best Album of 2007 for River, your Joni Mitchell album. Here's a little of the title track with Corinne Ray on vocals.
It's coming on Christmas. They're cutting down trees. They're putting up reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. I wish I had a river.
I love how she lingered on that note, more than Joni did on the original, which was also great.
Oh, yeah. We took that liberty. At that.
Why was the time right, so relatively recently, 2007, for working with some of the older Joni Mitchell material?
The time was right because it felt right. And because Joni is a dear friend of mine, and she has so much talent. She's a real Renaissance person. And I thought, here's a way that I can explore something that I never paid that much attention to before as an instrumentalist, a jazz instrumentalist, which is lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And what better lyricist could I pick than Joni Mitchell?
The revelation from the book that some people are talking about is that you reveal that you had a crack problem and that with your first taste of it, you knew it would cause you a problem. But the way you describe that time, you were very high functioning. Mostly you did it away from your family. You did it away from performing. Why do so many of the legendary jazz musicians seem to have drug problems? Do crack or heroin or whatever first open up channels of creativity before they take people down?
Well, it would be nice to be able to say there's one thing that affects everybody and that's the reason why it happens. No, it's not like that. For me, it just had to do with my innate curiosity. You know, cocaine wasn't unfamiliar to me, you know, considering the time I was brought up, you know, going through the 60s when people were exploring all kinds of things. But I wasn't looking for something to help my music. I wasn't missing something from my life. I was just curious. I want to see what is it that everybody's talking about that everybody says is so dangerous. I figured that let me see what it is, and then I'll know why it's so dangerous. Guess
it was
what?
Dangerous.
I found out immediately why it's so dangerous, and that was the first time I understood what addiction really was about, that doorway.
Who's the greatest jazz piano player you ever saw? Yourself not included. Some people would say it's you. Pure chops, just the most monster player.
Oh, just for chops?
Chops. Or you don't have to answer it that way.
Art Tatum.
Chops and expressiveness combined?
It's
creativity. Anybody?
Why are you asking me?
You don't like the question. You don't have to answer the question.
No, because I get so much from so many different musicians. I mean, Bill Evans was a big influence on me, but also a man named Chris Anderson that I met in Chicago some years ago, who actually wound up in New York for several years. He lived here and passed away not that long ago, but. He was the first person to show me some ways of playing that related to some older styles of music, but hadn't been really translated into a modern form.
How about any of your own musical highest experiences? Like during a concert or a recording session or composing, whatever, does anything come to mind?
Stylistically?
Just however, the best feeling when you were working. Some of the moments that you would – one moment because we're going to run out of time.
Oh, okay. When I was writing the song Maiden Voyage, I remember that I had this assignment for a television commercial. I had to do the music for it. And I had everything done except I couldn't figure out how to resolve the song, that like the last part of it. So it resolves to a certain key. And my wife kicked me out of bed and said, finish the song, because I had to have it the next day. And I kept going over the same thing over and over again.
And there we have to leave it.
That's all I needed.
And that's all we got. Herbie Hancock, his new memoir is called Possibilities. Such an honor. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, man.
Coming up next, astronaut Chris Hadfield shares some photos of our planet taken from space. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's the best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we usually see our next guest in videos where he's floating around the International Space Station. But the astronaut, Colonel Chris Hadfield, is in our studios today sitting. You might know him from his educational videos or his beautiful singing voice. Remember that Space Oddity cover? Today we're going to talk about the photographs he took in orbit, out now in a collection called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes. Chris Hadfield, welcome to WNYC. We so much had enjoyed having you on the program in the past on the phone. It's great to see you in person.
It's great to see you live and in person.
And listeners, we have 11 of these gorgeous photographs that Colonel Chris Hadfield took in space. So you can follow along with this conversation as we go through them. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And the book is called Around the World in 92 Minutes, because what happens in 92 minutes?
Amazingly enough, you go all the way around the planet every 92. The world turns underneath you like one of those snow globes just slowly turning. But you make it all the way back around. You get a sunrise, a sunset, and a whole circumnavigation of the planet in the time it takes to commute to work.
It's amazing. Is that affected at all by the craft you're in? Is it the same for the Contemporary International Space Station as it was for John Glenn once upon a time?
It's purely a function of altitude. The moon takes about a month to go around. It's like swinging a rock on the end of a ball of string. The shorter the string, the faster you have to spin it to keep it out. And the closer you get to Earth, the faster you go to go around. So the height of the space station or the height of John Glenn and Freedom 7, they're the same, about a half, an hour and a half.
So how fast does it look to you like the Earth is spinning when you're looking at that speed from that vantage point? You know, when you fly in a regular airplane, you're going like, what, 500 miles an hour? But it doesn't look like you're going that fast.
We go from L.A. to New York in 9 minutes.
Wow.
It goes by fast. And especially if you grab a camera lens and look straight down, because then you get the ground rush of it. You really sense how – I mean, if you want to get a good picture of New York, you got to get your camera ready over L.A. because by the time you get to camera set, you know, it's coming up and zipping past underneath you.
So what kind of camera are you using up there before we get some of these shots?
NASA puts a variety of cameras up over the years. Currently it's Nikon sort of standard with a digital D2s, D3s, and D4s, and they're really good cameras. They get hammered by the radiation, though. They actually, the little sensor chip in the back gets decayed by the high energy particles from the universe. So they have to keep replacing the camera bodies, but they take some great pictures.
And on Earth, most of us understand the basics of taking a photograph in relation to the sun. We can play with shadows. We can make sure we're not taking a backlit photo of a person if we don't want them to be backlit. Pretty simple stuff. But on the International Space Station, your relationship with the sun is totally different, and the angles are changing in different ways. Where do you start with that?
Well, I've had professional photographers teaching me, all the other astronauts teaching us all the time about basic use of the camera, of how to set the settings on the camera so that they're good for Earth observation. It's much simpler now than it used to be. Cameras are smarter in internal intelligence. But then what to take a picture of is as important. And we have geologists train us and geographers train us, you know, how to compose a picture, what is interesting to look at, what's been photographed a lot. And so you go into that with this barrage of knowledge, and then suddenly you're by the window and trying to photograph the world.
So let's get to some of these examples and see how many we can talk about. And listeners, again, if you're just joining us, astronaut Chris Hadfield with us. And you can go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to see the slideshow of selected photographs from his book and follow along. And the first one is of the Nile.
Yeah, not just the Nile, though, but that whole end of the Mediterranean, the prehistoric origins of so much of what we call civilization. The first place we walked out of Africa, whatever, 70,000 years ago, it's all in this little snapshot
you
right here.
You can see Cairo and Jerusalem.
And Jerusalem, both where the pyramids are and the Suez Canal and the whole Sinai Peninsula and the Gulf of Aqaba and all the way around Israel. And it's just a glimpse out the window.
And the Nile, if people are looking at it, is kind of this long stretch that's glittering.
Yeah, because of the way the Horn of Africa and Asia and Africa are ripping apart from each other, it's kind of pushed up the Nile. The Nile should have flowed into the other body of water a long time ago, but it routed so far north and then to Cairo and Alexandria like a big triangle at the end just before it flows into the Med.
Before we even get to the next shot, just a perspective question on our existence, never mind what things look like, because you note that this 4,258-mile brain of human life, first navigated end-to-end in 2004, I'm reading your words, is visible in a single glance from space. So do views like this one make you feel that we humans are so small on this planet or in the universe, or do you see it as a vast expanse of humanity kind of running things?
No, it puts us into the right perspective. And that's really one of the motivations, Brian, in doing this book was for people to truly see us, that you are here and this is the global perspective. And there are a little over 7 billion of us on the planet, but I get to see from the space station everybody. Every single day, you get to see all 7 billion people and the history of it. You can come across Africa and look one side all the way to Lake Victoria, to the source of the Nile, and the other side all the way to the Mediterranean, you know, Stanley and Livingston and all that. It's just a glance out the window, and it really puts it all into the accurate proportion of the world, and I think that view is a rare and important one.
All right, next up is a view of Venice, and it's called Venice Floating, which might be an optimistic title. It's not Venice Sinking.
I had a hard time taking this picture because trying to get a clear day over Venice where you can really pick out the lagoons all around it and the flow in and out of the Med, and then the red-tiled roofs of Venice itself really stand out. And it does look like a little sort of ochre pink kind of island there in the middle of that lagoon. But, of course, over time, Venice has gone up and down, and the water levels have gone up and down, and it's a perpetual battle against the sea. And you see the little tiny line that links Venice back to the mainland there and all of the industry and farmland up in Italy.
How precariously it does. How obvious are the effects of climate change from space?
Well, climate change, there's natural climate change and there's human climate change. During my first space flight, a volcano in the Philippines, Mount Pinatubo, had just erupted, and it had filled the stratosphere with millions of tons of sulfur dioxide. So you could see the layers of the atmosphere like never before, like a multicolored layer cake because of all the particles up there. And that cooled the world by a degree. So that type of natural change you can see. Human-initiated climate change you see on a local scale all over the place. We dried up the Aral Sea, the fourth biggest sea on Earth, and we as people in one generation dried it up. And the pollution that you see over all of the big cities. Global climate change is insidious and much harder to see. You have to compare photos from when John Glenn flew and the early guys to now, and then you can start to see the shuttle shifting of where deserts start and end, what happened to Lake Chad, what's happening to our glaciers. It's really vivid. And then you can see the changes that we're impacting as well.
Astronaut and photographer Chris Hadfield, our special guest, his new book, Around the World in 92 Minutes. And we've got a slideshow of some selected photographs from this book on our site. If you're just joining us and you want to go take a peep, go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show, and you can follow along. We'll pick up in a couple of minutes with slide number 3, which is of the Himalayas. But I do want to let some callers have at you. George in Fairlawn, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Hi, I'm interested to know about how you can photograph the Earth when it's moving at whatever, 10,000 miles an hour. Shutter speeds and camera settings can you use to get it so clear?
George, we're going 17,500 miles an hour, but we're also about 1.3 million feet away. So you have to be like one of those rotating camera mounts. So as you're taking a picture of something, the camera is floating weightless in front of you, and you just get it going at the rate so that it stops the relative motion of the Earth as it pans by underneath you. Sort of like taking a picture of a bus going by on the road. If you carefully track the bus on the way by, you can keep it from being blurred. And you get good at it after a while. Even at night, George, we can get to the point where you can take handheld night shots of cities just because we get smooth enough with a weightless camera.
Peter in Nyack, you're on WNYC with Chris Hadfield. Hi, Peter.
Hi. It's a two-part question for your guest. Did you bring the guitar with you solely to do the Space Oddity song? And how many hoops did you have to jump through to get a guitar onto the space station?
Peter, there have always been guitars on space stations. There was one on the Russian space station Mir when I helped build it in 1995. And it was our psychiatrists that put the guitar up on the space station that's there right now. The NASA mental health support team, because they recognize how important music is to just being a person. There's music. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's in our most ancient cave remains. You find musical instruments. It's fundamental to being healthy psychologically. And so that guitar was already up there. I didn't. It's still up there right now. It's been around the world. Huh. Gosh, who knows? 80,000 times that guitar has been around the world. It's like Keith Richards, most traveled guitar in the world.
But let's go back to the slideshow. Image number 3. Folks, if you're on our site, it's a view of the Himalayas. and we can see the crisp, snow-capped ridges in a way not that different than you might shoot it from an airplane. Very recognizable and organic as what it is. And then image number four is a view of the Eye of the Sahara, a much more mysterious image, if I can go through two here and kind of compare and contrast.
The Himalayas, you can see where the Indian continent with continental drift jammed up into Asia. It's just crumpling up like someone was mashing two big plates of rock and sand together.
That's how the mountains were formed. Nowhere to go but up.
You can just see the Himalayas, and they're still forming and climbing. The next picture, the Eye of the Sahara, it's also called the Rishat structure. It's weird. It's like an all-day sucker.
It's really weird. I mean, this is the first one to me that really looks like some kind of abstract art.
It looks like someone has been licking an all-day sucker flat on one side. And in truth, the weather has been doing that with this structure for millions of years. And it looks like maybe it's a meteor crater, but it's a big dome where the weathering has shaved it off. And it's great in space because sometimes it's hard to tell where you are. But this thing, it's like, oh, okay, I know. I'm over Mauritania. That's the Rishat structure. Okay, now I know where I am.
All right. We've done the Nile. We've done the Himalayas. We've done Venice. We've done the Sahara. We're going to get a little closer to home.
That sounds
now.
Funny. We've done all those places.
That's it. You know, hey, done. You've been on for, 12 minutes already. You know, we're done. But we're going to get a little closer to home with image number five, Detroit, Michigan, and Windsor, Ontario, across the Canadian border. Two countries, one river, and the Detroit River is such a bright blue in this photograph. Is that a trick of the sun?
Well, it's a time of year in the springtime when you get a lot of sediment coming down with the remains of the ice down the river, and you get just the right sun glint, a little bit of ripple of wind, and then the sun, the color of rivers constantly changes because of it. And the human history that's in this picture, you can see the original French settlement because of the way the farms are divvied up, and you can see the difference in the settlement of Windsor and Detroit on the two sides of the same river. There's politics, there's geography, there's geology, and there's the change of the seasons all in just a glance.
And image number six, and if you want to skip right to this one, folks, and see how New York looks from space, this is it. It's two views of the five boroughs at 9:23 in the morning local time, and then 3:45 in the morning local time, the contrast between day and night, basically, and it looks kind of like silver and gold.
Yeah, the millions of people and the impact they have on what was a huge forest originally, and the difference of how that looks when the sun is bouncing off the concrete. You can see Central Park really clearly, but then at night obviously the city doesn't sleep because it shines like a beacon from space.
And you can see the fiber, like, folks, think about a subway map, kind of, where in the one frame you can see basically, the five boroughs of the city. What kind of a lens are you using to get that close from that far?
If you want a view out of the space station that looks like what your eyeball sees, we use about a 50-millimeter lens. It's pretty good. If you want the big curve of the Earth, use a fisheye. But for a picture like this where you're trying to see Manhattan or the shadows during the daytime, the shadows of the buildings on the Hudson, then we use a 400-millimeter lens, which on Earth is a real arm breaker after a while. But in weightlessness, it's beautiful. It just floats on your camera, and you just carelessly have this huge lens, and it brings out the detail like in these two pictures.
And yet I didn't know if you were going to say a 4,000-millimeter lens. I mean, a 400 is something that photographers here would, if they're professional photographers trying to get really close to something, use.
Sure. That's the one the football players blunder into on the edge of the field, right, when they kick the player there or the cameraman there. It's not an unusual lens. It's just a really unusual tripod that we're on.
Aaron in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your question for astronaut Chris Hadfield?
I'm curious what your actual mission objectives were when you were on the International Space Station.
Aaron, there's a whole suite of them. We run about 200 experiments on the space station. Inside, there are a whole bevy of experiments taking advantage of weightlessness. It's the only laboratory the U.S. has that has perpetual weightlessness. And then on the outside, we're trying to find what the universe is made of. We only know what 6% of the universe is made of. We can't account for 94% of everything. So we're collecting subatomic particles to try and figure that out. And we use it to look at the world. We're also, what do you make a spaceship out of? If we're ever going to sail out of sight of land, what do you make the hull out of? How do you protect a crew? How do you keep them sane? How do you build toilets? How do you make communication, navigation? We have to invent all those things and test them somewhere. So it's a test bed. And then it's really an eye on ourselves and an eye on the world. It's a really interesting international symbol of cooperation right now, where we've probably never needed one more.
So you're really busy up there in orbit. You're tweeting out photographs. You're explaining stuff in cool videos. You're playing guitar and singing. And I know you're not the only astronaut doing that. In our last minute or two, do you all talk about being, you know, part of that being part of the mission? Is social media an official part of the NASA strategy now?
NASA has always led the world in showing people what we're doing. I mean, the moon landing, think how brave that was. The odds of disaster were huge. And yet NASA could have been excused for saying, we might blow it or crash or something. We'll just show people after we've succeeded. But they didn't. It was reality television. They said, whatever happens, we're going to show everybody. And the impact was enormous. Billions of people were aware of that and thought about the world and themselves differently. And so I think that kind of set the standard. And we've always used the best of technology to share what's going on. And I was just lucky to be up there when in fact, we have primitive but available internet on the station.
And listeners, if you want to keep going through the slideshow, the next ones you'll see that we won't have time to talk about, a view of Cuba and Florida, a really playful one of the Great Salt Lake in Utah. 15 seconds. You were most recently the commander of the International Space Station. Any plans to go back?
Oh, it's not up to me. I served 21 years in the astronaut corps and 35 years for the government. So I'm a private citizen now. But I teach at university and lecture. And this book is my best effort to share what the world really, truly looks like.
And it is really special. As we leave it there with astronaut Chris Hadfield, his new book is a collection of photographs from the International Space Station. It's called You Are Here Around the World in 92 Minutes. Such a treat. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
And we end with a song that Commander Hadfield recorded live from space with his floating guitar. It's called Is Somebody Singing?
That ball of shiny blue houses everybody anybody ever knew.
And that's it for our special Brian Lehrer Show Christmas Eve Toast to the Arts, some of our favorite recent arts-oriented segments. Hope you have a lovely day with your loved ones if that's what you're doing. And Merry Christmas to all of you who celebrate. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
See our nation from the International Space Station. You know why.